His body exhibits the 32 major and 80 minor marks of perfection. I won't list these. You can imagine what they might be. Long ear lobes, a little tuft of hair right between his eyebrows. For it is the repository of the whole host of excellent qualities, the 10 powers, fearlessness, and the rest. His body has no apertures, flesh, or bone, for it is neither true nor false, like the pure light that's reflected in a mirror. He is black in color because he is permeated with great compassion, and his symbol is a black vajra, or thunderbolt, which embodies the five constituents of the pure absolute. This is a classic description of the process that visualizes Akshobhya in the center of the mandala. Now, the text goes on to say that Akshobhya is associated with consciousness, anger, the middle of the day, knowledge, space, sound, and in the system of the alphabet, the cha series of consonants. Now, when you put all these symbolic associations together, not just for Akshobhya, but for all of the Buddhas, the mandala gives you what, in effect, is a symbolic map of all of reality. You have visualized in that mandala everything and connected it to all the aspects of reality that you can name: constituents of the personality, the time of the day, the time of the year, the directions of the cosmos. All of those things have been established in this visualized system of the mandala. In other words, to use language that we've used before in this course, the mandala serves as a mesocosm, a middle realm that unites the microcosm of the personality with the macrocosm of the external world. This union of microcosm and macrocosm is similar to the union that we talked about in the Hindu tradition, in the Upanishads, when we were beginning to discuss the shape of Indian religion. But it's much more complex and detailed than anything we saw in the Upanishads. For one thing, it represents a very precise view of the structure of the world. At the center of this world system, as it's visualized in the mandala, is a mountain. We haven't talked about this before. It's a sacred mountain that rises up in the center of the world. The name of this mountain is Mount Meru. And around this mountain, according to traditional Buddhist cosmology, are four continents that are like triangular-shaped geographical entities. In traditional Buddhist cosmology, our home, place where we live, is the southernmost continent that's known as Jambudvipa or the Rose Apple Island. So we live on one of the four petals, as it were, or triangular shapes that extends out of the central mountain of the cosmos. It's Mount Meru. Now you can see that this cosmology, this vision of the world, corresponds roughly to the geography, as you would expect, of India. There are mountains in the north. Behind those, that initial range of mountains may very well be a mountain that's even higher than anything that we can see, Mount Meru, up there somewhere in the north, beyond the main range of the Himalayas. And then, of course, extending down from this mountainous region is the triangular shape of the Indian subcontinent. But one of the interesting things about this Indian vision of the world, it's found in Hinduism as well as in Buddhism, is that it's translatable and it can be rendered by some process of analogy in other spaces as well. One of the fascinating things to do when you visit Indonesia, actually, is to go to Bali, that Hindu and Buddhist island in Indonesia that still bears the marks in so many ways of tantric ritual, and see how the sacred geography has manifested itself in Balinese life. You can imagine, even if you haven't been to Bali, that it's an island, it's a volcanic island that has a large central volcano that's the most holy space on the island. And a lot of the ritual in Balinese Hinduism has to do with capturing and manipulating and processing the sacred water that flows out of that central volcano. Well, how is the sacred volcano understood? As a version of Mount Meru,